From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the effects of same-sex conversion therapy, this idea that you can cure a gay person. They've been pretty much debunked at this point, but they still exist. And LGBTQ advocates in Utah are trying to introduce a bill that would ban them. We'll also talk to Garrett Conley, who wrote the book which inspired the movie Boy Erased, about his own experience in one of these programs. We'll be right back.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, you may know the story of Garrett Conley, surviving a Christian gay conversion therapy program. His memoir, called Boy Erased, became a movie of the same name. There's a podcast about his story, too, produced by Jad Abumrad of Radiolab. It looks at the history of these programs as well. Garrett was an evangelical Christian, and when his parents learned he was gay, he was 19 years old, they insisted he enroll in the Love in Action program. It was supposed to cure him of his homosexuality. The idea was he would emerge from it straight and cleansed of his sins. But those programs don't work, and this one certainly didn't for Garrett. The fact is, it's becoming more and more clear these kinds of conversion programs do far more damage than good. A new study conducted at Stanford University showed LGBTQ young people who go through conversion therapy are 63% more likely to attempt suicide. They have 52% higher levels of depression. They're more likely to become addicted to drugs and alcohol. They have less success in school and lower incomes. Today in the program, we're talking about the impacts of these kinds of programs and a bill being introduced in the Utah legislature to do away with those targeted at young people. First, Garrett Conley, who's in Utah today. He joined us recently to talk about his experience, and he says in his book that as he tried to reconcile his sexuality with his religious upbringing, he spent years trying to erase his false personality.
I'd grown up in a very small community. My father became a pastor of a missionary Baptist church, and when the subject of homosexuality would come up, we were told that it's just like how you don't murder someone when you get angry at them. You might feel like strangling someone, but you don't act on it. And to give people some context, this was the time period when Matthew Shepard was a big news item, and we were being told many times in churches that he kind of deserved it. He was seen as someone who was coming on to someone, and they killed him. And so many of these parents in these small towns believed that living openly gay meant that I would be murdered or somehow abused. So that false personality was anything that contradicted that belief that I grew up with.
Your father, this was interesting, he made a mark on your foot when you were first born. Wanted to make sure you didn't get switched with any of the other babies. He was kind of paranoid. You write about that. But it was also this, you came to see it as this, even though it kind of faded, you came to see it as this special mark, something you say that kept you protected. To me, that seems to say something about the way you think and thought of your relationship with your father. Say something about that, if you would.
Well, my dad, first of all, is a very innovative person. That's one way to put it. He loves to think outside the box. I mean, I think he's creating a new patent right now that I can't even talk about. He's very excited. It was kind of fun to be around and infectious. But my dad, you know, he was very worried. It took my parents a long time to have a child, and the first child was stillborn. And so they were very, very nervous about this pregnancy, and my mom was told the risk, and they decided to go through with it. So when I was born, my dad was super worried that somebody would switch the child, or I was too beautiful, you know?
Yeah.
So he made a mark, and I think that in my brain, I had to turn a lot of things that had suddenly become very ugly into something that fit my ideas of beauty.
Yeah.
I didn't want to just throw the past away and say all these quirky moments with my dad were just symptoms of a bizarre personality trait that became apparent when he became a pastor. You know, a sort of fundamentalism and a sort of fanaticism that we would easily write off today. I found some real beauty in his personality,
yeah,
and in those details. And so I had to sort of find meaning from my past in a way that allowed me to move on, but also to say these things were beautiful. And my father, he is somebody who finds beauty in a lot of strange places,
yeah,
and I wanted to keep that. So I guess that was the whole story of the footmarking.
I noticed that you had said something toward the end of the book where you're talking about watching your father caring for his own father.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a man who had kind of brutally beaten his wife, and your father saw all of this. And you write, mm-hmm, about there being this mystery in that affection and love that he felt for this flawed man. I'm wondering if that mystery is related to love, whether it makes sense entirely. And I wonder if you feel that same kind of thing for your father.
I get in a lot of trouble for telling these family secrets, but I think they need to be aired. My grandfather was horribly violent to my grandmother, and he would tie her up to a chair and make my father watch this beating. And so this is a man who experienced an incredible amount of violence. He himself was also beaten, and he never once hit me. And I think that that should be really commended. Mm. I know that that's a low bar for a lot of people, but cycles of violence are incredibly difficult to escape. And he never resorted to any of that. There was abuse whenever he sent me to conversion therapy, but it was a different kind of abuse.
Yeah.
And I think that should be noted. And I think that my father, he must have hated his father at times, and he must have seen him as weak and also terrifyingly powerful. But there was something that made him, and I don't think it was just this sort of clan mentality, or blood mentality, that made him come back to that hospital bed and take care of him at the end. I think that there's something more profound there.
Yeah.
I did want to honor that definition of love that my father offered me was 10 times more valuable than any of the definitions that a place like Love in Action, where I attended conversion therapy, offered me. And there were real lessons to be learned in my childhood. And I know that's difficult for people to understand, because what they see is the abuse of conversion therapy, rightly so.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to write a book that was simply yelling at these people who had sent me to conversion therapy. If you're going to yell, I always say you yell at politicians and people in power and pastors of mega churches who've abetted this industry.
Mm.
But you don't necessarily yell at people like my father or my mother, because they were duped just like everybody else. Not to say that they didn't have agency in it, but when my father found out that I was gay, when I was outed, he went to Bellevue Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee, and he said, "What should I do?"
Yeah.
And they handed him some brochures and said, you know, send him off to this conversion therapy camp. And Dad had never even heard of it. He didn't even do any research, because he thought, these are men of God. They know what they're talking about. It was a very patriarchal system.
Your story, of course, is played out in the book and now the film, of course. I want to talk about the podcast, which is connected to the film, because it digs into the history, like a deeper context,
mm-hmm,
for how these conversion therapy programs came to be. Say something about the podcast, if you would, first of all, because this is another way of looking at this story, giving It's with Jad Abumrad. It's a deeper dive, I think, on another angle to the story.
I mean, I never imagined that my book would become a film and then I would make a podcast with Jad Abumrad,
yeah.
Who is a personal hero of mine. I've been listening to Radiolab for, I think, 14 years now. But whenever we learned that there was going to be this high-profile film, I knew this was my moment to make Boy Erased a bigger project, because a film can only do so much in 2 hours. It's almost, you know, it's a message film. It has to really hammer the issue home and become a talking point for many, I think, somewhat conservative parents and kids who are queer. And I really wanted it to accomplish that task. It was an activist film in my mind.
Yeah.
But what I truly wanted to do was to show a bit more of the history of conversion therapy, and you can't do that in a 2-hour film. My co-producer, David Craig, who was also a co-producer on the film, he said, hey, we should just do a podcast. And I was so excited. And then because of our connections that we developed through the film, we were able to sit down in a meeting with Jad Abumrad and a few other people, and Michael Excelsior, and we wanted to make sure that this podcast really explored the full history and different angles of conversion therapy, not just how it happened, but the other types of people that were affected by it. So you look at mothers of conversion therapy survivors. You look at the person who was one of the original architects of conversion therapy. You look at the person who was the head of Love in Action that taught me conversion therapy. And you also look at my own experience. From the outset, we said, this is a different project from the film. We do not want this to be PR for a film. We want it to exist on its own. And I think it does. And I think it tells a broader story.
I wanted to tease out a few moments from the podcast, and you mentioned that it tells the story of one of the architects of these original therapies, Dr. Jerry Davison. One particular moment I want to play for it. It's a really critical moment, but tell us first, Agared, who Jerry Davison is. I mean, he's instrumental in developing these, I mean, they sound awful now, but these aversion therapies, basically.
Yeah. Well, it sounds strange, but he was approaching conversion therapy, aversion therapy at the time, from a very compassionate stance. He thought that there was this problem in the LGBTQ community because people were saying, you know, I can't live a normal life. I can't be happy and out. And so he thought he was fulfilling a real need coming from the community. He'd heard this, you know, not necessarily from the community itself, but mostly from other people dealing with it in this field. And so he started to do what you've heard of, which is aversion therapy, where oftentimes people would be watching, you know, two men together, and then they would be given something to make them sick, and that was supposed to associate their negative feelings with an open gay relationship. It was the kind of stuff that we look at and we say, how can this have ever happened?
Yeah. And Davison, what the podcast really gets into is his conflicted feelings about all of this and how he sort of comes around to this really crucial point. And this is in 1972, and the podcast tells the story of how he's invited to speak at this conference in Chicago. And by this point, he's come to kind of a different way of thinking about all of this. You know, he hears about this, the idea of it inflicting pain, that bothers him. But then this question, and this is the part I want to play, it's raising the question of whether or not this was moral. And so he has this, will you set this up for us? He's giving this speech in front of these therapists, like 1,000 of them.
He spoke with the activist, right?
Yeah, Charles.
Who said, Charles, what's important to note here in terms of LGBTQ history is this was the first time he was really confronted by the community itself and was told, like, this is a systemic bigotry that exists in our community, and of course we've internalized it, and of course we want to cure ourselves because we want to be just like everybody else and we want to have all of your rights, but is it something that is good, as you said, is it a moral thing to do? Which often I think science gets ahead of.
Yeah, right.
And then we start asking those questions too late.
Yeah. Well, here's a moment from the podcast Unerased. You'll hear Jad Abumrad and that activist we were mentioning, Charles Silverstein.
Charlie says he was the first person to say that.
To ever say that trying to change sexual orientation was an immoral thing to do.
And that's not a trivial thing. I mean, you could see this moment in a way as one of the early tremors in a tectonic shift in not just therapy, but all of science. Like, science to that point had concerned itself with objectivity. That was all that mattered. We stand apart from the world and we examine it as it is, objectively. But that, from this moment forward, would start to be questioned all over the place, even in places like mental illness. You know, you look at history, you see that some diseases come and go. Why would that be? Well, people would begin to argue that even mental illnesses are social constructs created by the society, by the people who study them. What Jerry was doing here, he was shifting the language. He was saying, forget objectivity, forget bullshit empiricism. Let's talk about ethics. Let's talk about morality. We shouldn't do this, not because it doesn't work, which it doesn't, but because it's wrong.
I hope and I recommend that we continue to devote the necessary energy to the important challenges. Thank you.
You write about that moment, like as you were talking about how like the air felt in that moment. You write, friends commented afterwards that one gets that kind of silence when everyone in a room full of 1,000 people stops breathing at the same time.
I love that moment because it's like, yeah. What are they going to do? And it's crickets, basically.
It's also just so bold of him to just make that stance as a straight man. You know, because he talks about how after that, a lot of people made fun of him and said, oh, well, I guess you're a fairy now, which is not an easy thing to do, especially at that time. I just can't imagine how hard that would be. But he's a hero. It's funny, you know, like one of the architects of aversion therapy is also a hero.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you made some...
Stories aren't simple.
No. I want to talk about another one of the episodes that you mentioned. And this is the story of the mama bears. These are the mothers...
Oh, love them.
...of victims of these therapies, basically. And there's so many different... ways of talking about this. Liz Dyer is a really interesting story. What I like about the podcast, Liz, her son comes out to her and she does not know what to do with it. She's a devout evangelical Christian. And so she digs into the Bible. And then there's this part of the podcast where you actually break down, what does it actually say in the Bible about homosexuality? This is a really interesting thing. And Liz, she is a great researcher. She digs in, and there's a lovely part there. But I wanted to talk about Kimberly Shapley. Tell her story, if you would, because I want to play a moment here that she says. It's just what she loses and the connection she finds, the family she finds.
It's devastating. So Kimberly recognized that her child was trans, and the community that she grew up in and that they lived in pretty much just flat out rejected their family whenever her child started dressing differently. And it was just a really terrible time in her life. She just had no community to turn to. And she ended up finding this community of mama bears who are these women who are very strong, who've been through similar circumstances, and they turn toward each other. And they have a really strong online network. My mom is part of it, and it's a wonderful, beautiful, blossoming community.
Here's a moment from that episode in the podcast. We'll hear from Kimberly, who, as you'll hear, she basically loses everyone. I mean, she's deeply conservative, politically and religiously, and then because of someone she loves, she begins to change, and people around her can't accept it. Here's a moment.
My mother doesn't speak to me. I've lost my siblings. I've lost my aunts, uncles, cousins, my best friends.
She basically lost everyone.
The media, especially, you know, Facebook and Twitter, they were horrible to us, the things that they were saying. And I let the moms know, like, wow, I don't know how to handle this. I've never been attacked like this before. And literally the moms activated, and they just jumped in, and they were defending us, and they were very active in shutting it down. And it was really nice for me, having just lost all of my family, my church, my friends. It's really nice when you have this huge group of women who you've never even met before, but they have the same heart. And they just get in and they defend you and they stand in the gap for you. And they get in there and they get messy and they stay up all night online just to make sure that you're okay. I made a comment on there that, you know, that my sisters had disowned me and I literally had no family left. And moms in the group actually went onto my Facebook page and listed me as their sister. That may not seem important to just anybody, but in my shoes, it was a really big deal. A really big deal.
Gary, do you think you understand now why would a mother or a father choose their church first, their religious beliefs first, their God first, over their kid?
Well, first of all, that clip almost makes me cry every time I hear it.
But, yeah, it's powerful. I
happen to know a lot about that.
Yeah.
And I think, well, I know the reason is that you're told to value your relationship with God, your personal relationship with God and Jesus, in these evangelical communities, that it's more important than even your family, and that your family has to get in line behind that kind of thinking. And if they don't, then they're backslidden, then they're out of the fold. And so there's a fear that if one strays from that relationship that should trump everything else, that you'll lose your family in the end anyway. That if you turn against God, then everything will be lost. The problem is we try to simplify these stories they did this abuse because of a literal interpretation of the Bible. Well, that's only one part of it. They did this abuse because they didn't want to be shunned by their community. Yeah, but also, you know, there are all these other factors. And I think it's very hard to step outside of that world and take a stance, especially when if you own a business in that town, you are going to be ostracized. If you take a stance like that.
It brings us to John Smid, the character played by Joel Edgerton in the film. And the podcast tells his story. Episode 4, the last episode, talks about the so-called violent shifts in his life. And it's he's gay. He's married at first. He gets a divorce from his first wife, lives as a gay man, but then suffers these humiliations and heartbreaks, and then starts to rethink his life, and then he becomes connected to Christianity again, and he develops these programs, this conversion therapy program that you were involved in that was so devastating for so many people. And then the twist there, of course, is that he eventually confesses that he hasn't been cured, gets a divorce, he's now married to a man. And there's this question that Jad Abumrad asks in the podcast that I wanted to ask you about, because it raises this question about what we're supposed to do with John Smith's story. And it seems to get at what you were just talking about there, how complicated all of this is. Let me play this moment. This is Jad from episode 4 of Unerased.
How to think about John Smid is a difficult question. He is undeniably warm and funny and honest and engaging. At the same time, many people told us before we came, don't forget, this is a guy who ran a program where people in the program tried to commit suicide. And in some cases succeeded. And now that he's out himself and married to a man and vehemently opposed to the whole idea of conversion therapy, it does beg the question, what do we do with that past? How should we think about it? Is he allowed to just move on?
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question that I asked frequently when I was writing my book. And when I developed this really, at least at the beginning, very odd relationship with him post-therapy, I always want to get the story right. So when I was writing my book, I interviewed my parents and I interviewed other survivors and I interviewed John, who had, you know, basically subjected me to torture.
Yeah.
And we became Facebook friends and started chatting. And he had this viewpoint that has shifted over time. I think he's now thinking, you know, correctly about everything. But at the time, he kept saying things like, well, I did help a lot of people because I provided the space for them to talk truthfully about their feelings. And that's actually kind of true. You know, for many of these people that went into conversion therapy, they'd never talked about their sexuality in any setting, and they never felt comfortable enough to do it. And so he did provide the space for them. And I think that that also makes conversion therapy a bit more insidious because you feel comfortable enough to say things and then those things are used against you. It's like, you know, you get this sudden rush of freedom and that freedom is used to condemn you for something. And I just kept thinking, like, I know that people committed suicide because of you. I know that I wanted to commit suicide because of you. I wasted 10 years of my life in many ways thinking about what you told me. And I kind of don't ever want you to be happy or experience another moment of happiness in your life.
Yeah.
And I want you to apologize for the rest of your life and be shamed. And of course, as anyone knows that has held a grudge for a long time, it's just not sustainable to have that kind of anger. And I think that I learned that if I'm going to get really smart about ending conversion therapy, if I'm going to be a voice that will help in a much larger array of voices, that I have to be very pragmatic. And I have to think about this man as a tool that we can use for the fight. And having someone who was in, you know, running conversion therapy for, I believe, over a decade, say publicly in multiple formats, this never worked. It never will work. It was all a mistake. No one has ever been cured. That is an incredibly powerful tool, especially against some of these right-wing conservatives who do not believe that we're human. I don't care if these people that I'm trying to convince see me as a human being. I don't need them marching in pride parades. I need them to not subject their children to torture. That's really where I am. And that is a really sad, you know, bare minimum.
Yeah.
But it's one that I've learned I have to adopt in order to move forward. And so I became closer to John in that fight. I began to actually see him as a human who was also in pain and who was subjecting himself to pain by continually sticking his neck out. And that's not to absolve him from what he's done. I will never truly forgive him for what he's done. I can't. But I did, in the small amount of time that I've been doing this, I was able to really see the kinds of messages that he was receiving, especially, I mean, he received so much more hate mail than I ever did because he turned on them.
Yeah.
you know, he turned against his own community. And that's incredibly difficult. And I think that, you know, it's never going to be uncomplicated when I talk about John Smith. And there will be certain moments where he'll say something that drives me up the walls and I will go back into my old hatred of him. But I think if there's one potentially illogical belief that I have from my Christian upbringing, it's that people can really change. And I believe in it. I mean, I know that the world can turn you cynical very easily, especially when you're doing this kind of work. But I've seen it. I've seen it in my mother, and I've seen it in somebody like Smith. The change might not be as great as the one that happened to my mother, but it's there. And I have to believe it if I'm going to keep going forward, because otherwise there's no point.
Garrett Conley. His memoir is Boy Erased. He's partnered with Radiolab to produce a four-part podcast called Unerased. Tonight at 6:30 at the Salt Lake City Public Library, Equality Utah is hosting an event as part of their Q Talk series. It will feature several survivors of conversion therapy, including Garrett himself. He'll also be signing books. You can visit radiowest.org for more information and details. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking with Garrett Conley about his experience with gay conversion therapy. As you heard, those kinds of programs can have a profound impact on the people who try them. They're left confused and ashamed and traumatized. LGBTQ advocates want to put a stop to these programs, and it turns out that's complicated. You can't really do much about the ones designed for adults, but you can for the ones targeted at young people. Joining us now on the program is Troy Williams. He's executive director of Equality Utah, and Clifford Roski, who's a professor of law at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He serves on the Equality Utah Advisory Council. Equality Utah is one of the groups hoping to introduce a bill at the legislature this year banning conversion therapy programs for minors. It seems surprising that this is still happening. It seems like the practices, the psychology, the quote-unquote science behind these ideas has been so discredited for so long now. Is this still happening, these conversion therapy programs?
Yeah. In fact, just earlier this week, I had a phone call from a 19-year-old person from Lehigh. And he told me that his story, coming out and seeking out a therapist, and again, that the therapist started through the old patterns, talking about his relationship with his parents as the origin of his same-sex attractions, and then giving him all of these things, these assignments to do, go work out more in the gym, get your chest bigger, your arms bigger, don't cross your legs when you sit, speak deeper with your voice. Wow. And all of these things, and he was promised that these things would help reduce his same-sex attractions. And he said, I never felt body shame until I started going to therapy just a couple years ago. So yes, conversion therapy is still happening, and it's happening here in Utah.
Cliff Roski, do you worry about the fact that people would be mystified that this is, in fact, still happening? That, no, that's a thing of the past. So why are you doing this bill?
This has been a problem within the LGBT community and even within the LGBT movement, since the very early beginnings of the campaign to end conversion therapy in the early 90s, the response was, even back then, people don't really do this anymore, do they? And it is a misconception. They have and continue to engage in these harmful practices. And, you know, the Williams Institute at UCLA found that 700,000 Americans have been subjected to this treatment, half of them as adolescents. Mm-hmm. There have been lawsuits, for example, in New Jersey, a successful consumer fraud lawsuit proving that people had engaged in the practice there in very large numbers, charging people exorbitant fees to engage in these ineffective and fraudulent practices. So it's a longstanding misconception that we're still up against, and you know, we have the data and we just have to get the word out.
I want to talk about what the bill does and doesn't do that you have in mind. Let's talk about what it doesn't do, first of all. It doesn't apply to adults, and it only applies to licensed therapists. But why? Because it seems to me, I don't know, a big part of the problem is in unlicensed therapists. So start there.
So from the beginning, 14 states now passed laws banning conversion therapy, and all of them have those two features. And the reasons are pretty straightforward. It's well established that states have the authority to require professionals to obtain licenses and set the conditions under which they practice their professions, namely complying with the profession's ethical standards. Once you move beyond a state licensing regime and you're just regulating private individuals, then you get into freedom of speech issues and freedom of religion issues. And so you'd be, you know, potentially violating the First Amendment by telling someone, for example, what they can say to their child or what they can say, you know, to the people within their religious congregation. So that frames the issue. And, of course, with respect to minors, it's difficult to say that they consent to a particular kind of treatment.
Yeah.
Whereas once people reach the age of majority, then they can sort of seek out the treatments with an understanding that they're not effective and they may be harmful.
But are you acknowledging that this does leave out a chunk of problematic people and therapies out there that are still there?
I think one of the important things to understand about legislation is that there are the terms of the bill itself, but there's also the process by which we go through, the education process, gathering stakeholders together, agreeing that a certain practice is harmful. That message reaches more broadly than the terms of the legislation itself.
Not so long ago, we talked about on our program a young woman named Alex Cooper in this book called Saving Alex. Basically, she comes out to her Mormon parents. They're in Southern California. They take her to Southern Utah into this quote-unquote residential treatment program, which was a nightmare. It was modeled over these boot camps, these therapeutic boot camps. Your bill wouldn't be able to help someone like Alex Cooper, it doesn't sound like.
Well, there's two things to know about that. The first is that, again, the process of going through a campaign to pass legislation like this involves educating the public and thought leaders, religious leaders, policymakers about the harmfulness of these kind of practices.
So just get it into public discourse, that can be helpful.
Right, because
there's
then,
only so much you can do with a bill.
Absolutely. I mean, the First Amendment is what it is.
Yeah.
You can't pass a law that violates it, right? But what you do through the process is you get the word out, and then when a child says, for example, Alex says, I'm lesbian to her parents, they read the paper, they watched something on TV, and they say, oh, wait a minute, I remember something about this. Mm-hmm. Maybe the things that I learned growing up aren't the right response here, and it gives them pause at that critical juncture in the child's life. The other thing to say about the scope of the bill is there are ways to regulate unlicensed people like life coaches who are engaging in fraudulent practices. Every state, including Utah, has a consumer fraud law that a business is not allowed to hold itself out based on false promises. And passing a piece of legislation like this could help establish the consensus that this is an ineffective, harmful and fraudulent practice. And so if people were to continue engaging in it, knowing that, that could help provide the basis for a lawsuit against such a person.
An important part of all of this is a study that was conducted not so long ago at Stanford that looked at the social impact, the health impact of these kinds of therapies. Cliff Roske, what you've said is that we've known for a long time that parental rejection is really bad. It drives up suicide rates. But this this seems to go a little further. It's directly related to health and the social outcomes. So say a little bit about this, if you would.
Yeah, so this study looked at what happens when not only a parent rejects the sexual orientation or gender identity of a child, but then sends that child out to someone outside of the family who would subject them to this practice of conversion therapy, attempting to, quote, cure their sexual orientation or gender identity. And they found really troubling high rates of depression and suicide. The rates of depression tripled among the LGBT youth subjected to this therapy, and the rates of suicide attempts nearly tripled. It was 63% among children subjected to conversion therapy.
And this study really tracks with the stories that we've been hearing here in Utah. The majority of these people described at one point either feeling suicidal or they attempted suicide. Now, we have a huge concern in this state about suicide rates. It's the leading cause of death for young people. Suicide rates have spiked 141% since 2011. And so for us and our concern, how do we help our LGBTQ community? Well, we're seeing all of these young people going through different forms of conversion therapies, and they're being pushed to the edge of suicide. Everyone describes to us the sense of failure that they experience and shame they experience when these techniques didn't work, didn't change or reduce their same-sex attractions. They felt like they had failed their therapist, failed their parents, and sometimes failed their God. And that, you know, drives up depression and suicide ideation.
Well, not only that, and I think it's also interesting in the study that talks about the impact it has on success later in life, the impact it has on substance abuse, the impact it just has on how much money you will make in your life. That's really interesting.
When you feel no hope in life, when you feel like you are broken, that you are fundamentally unlovable, that sense of shame is so great that, yes, it permeates all aspects of one's life.
I want to ask you about another one of the things the bill does not do. It does not affect non-licensed religious counselors. There's a freedom of speech aspect here that you don't want to tread on. But doesn't most of this, if not all of this, come from religious communities, these conversion therapies? So what do you do about that? And one of the things, Troy, you've talked about is you don't want to attack religious people. And in the case in Utah, it's mostly the LDS Church. Not exclusively, but I would guess mostly. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that question, the religious component of all of this?
It's incredibly difficult. I myself grew up as a Latter-day Saint, a gay Latter-day Saint, and so I know how difficult these conversations are. We want to continue to engage in dialogue with leaders of the church. We do, and we'll continue to do so, because ultimately I believe that faith leaders you know, they don't want young people taking their lives. I don't believe that they do, right? And so we need to take the opportunity to share these stories so that legislators, lawmakers, church leaders can hear about how some of these practices have really hurt people in their pews. Now, here's something we all need to recognize. We know from all the scientific data that religion is actually a protective factor. Young people who attend church on a regular basis are less likely to attempt suicide, which is why it is so dangerous and damaging when a faith community exiles a gay or a transgender youth from their congregations. So yeah, we do want the church to be all churches to be more inclusive and loving and supporting their members just as they are.
The other aspect of this is that by ensuring that licensed mental health professionals are not engaging in these harmful practices, we give youth a place to turn. They can go where they know that they're not going to be shamed. They're not going to be trapped, tortured, as your last guest said. That's an important component here, that there be one place that people can go, that children can go, where if they're exploring same-sex attraction or asserting an identity as LGBT, that they're that won't be rejected.
The LDS Church a few years ago came out with this statement about seeking professional help. You know,
right.
And a lot of people lauded this as really important. You had leaders, Elder Jeffrey R. Holland, who's one of the members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, who came out and said that if you need professional help dealing with mental health issues and other things, then go get it. It's fine. And I think that was remarkably helpful. In a statement that the LDS Church issued about seeking professional help, it says this: while shifts in sexuality can and do occur for some people, it is unethical to focus professional treatment on an assumption that a change in sexual orientation will or must occur. That's important, right? That seems like a big deal.
Yes, it's a positive step forward, and we applaud that. Absolutely. I think conversion therapy is fundamentally at odds with the very core of Latter-day Saint theology.
Do Latter-day Saints understand that?
I don't think that they do, because when you go in and look at the driving impetus between conversion therapy, it's that somehow the parent damaged the child. The parent is responsible. It's this, the absent father. It's the overbearing mother. And this creates this wedge, this divide between parent and child. And one of the most important things to protect a young person from suicide is that bond between parent and child. So, yeah, conversion therapy is incongruent with the teachings of the church.
So let's talk about the prospects for this bill as you're thinking about it right now. Lawmakers have had a hard time passing a hate crimes bill. Most people would argue because it includes the LGBT community. It offers what they see as extra protections that they don't necessarily need or deserve. Where are you on the way lawmakers, most of whom are Latter-day Saints, are going to approach this kind of bill? I'm not sure you're counting votes yet, but what do you think about the prospects right now?
You know, when you're doing this kind of work, you have to be tenacious. We've built a great relationship with a lot of lawmakers, and we have, doors are open in ways they haven't been before. But it took us 7 years to pass a non-discrimination law, and we're on year four now, working on an inclusive hate crimes law. Mm-hmm. The thing about Equality Utah is we're here to stay, and we're going to be up on Capitol Hill every single year until we ensure that all laws include and protect LGBTQ Utahns. So we're not going away, and we'll be up there as long as it takes to make sure that all of these bills are passed.
One of the things you said, Professor Roski, I think it's interesting, is you said that you're not interested in the idea of compromising on this particular idea. Did I get that right?
I don't think anyone is interested in compromising on the issue of youth suicide. How could they?
No way.
One thing I was going to say is that there is something that makes this bill and this issue different. You talk about 4 years, 7 years. In the meantime, children are dying. And so the governor and the lieutenant governor have recognized that we're in a crisis with respect to our youth suicide rate in this state. They've recognized that LGBTQ youth in Utah are especially vulnerable. And they've committed to addressing that issue this year. And I see no reason to wait, and many reasons not to.
Let me ask you finally. I think it was interesting if you looked at the role of the LDS Church in the Prop 2 situation with medical marijuana. When they get involved for or against something, it has a powerful, profound effect on the way people are thinking about it. I'm guessing part of your efforts for this bill will be trying to get some sort of endorsement or trying to get the LDS Church on board. What can you say about that at this point?
I serve on the governor's youth suicide task force with Elder LeGrand Clark from the 70. And we are in constant dialogue with the church and will continue to do so because we want LGBTQ Latter-day Saints to live healthy, happy lives. And I think that's a piece of common ground that we can build upon. So I think that the leaders of the church want their members to live happy, healthy lives. And so if we can find that common ground, we can make headway on this issue.
That's Troy Williams. He's executive director of Equality Utah. Clifford Roski teaches at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. He also serves on the Equality Utah Advisory Council. Tonight at 6:30 at the Salt Lake City Public Library, Equality Utah is hosting the latest in their Q-Talk series. It's going to feature survivors of conversion therapy, including Garrett Conley. You will need tickets, and there's information to get them on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.